You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. You know, it's not anyone who can say they've helped elect 19 women senators, 11 governors, and 110 Democratic women to the House. Ellen R. Malcolm, the founder of Emily's List, can. Emily's List is the nation's largest resource for women in politics, and Ellen Malcolm started it in response to a time when women who wanted to be in politics were not taken seriously. Does that sound familiar? And had no resources to aid their efforts. Now, as the 2016 presidential campaign rages, and does it ever rage, and we're just getting started, and with Hillary Clinton in the lead, there could not be a more appropriate time to reflect on how different the landscape of women in American politics looks today compared to 30 years ago. In Eleanor Malcolm's new book, When Women Win, Emily's List and the Rise of Women in American Politics, you'll hear the front row story of how Emily's List has paved the way to what may lead to the election of our first woman president. When Ellen Malcolm got her start in American politics 40 years ago, there was no such resource, and the men in power didn't want to make any room. In fact, they seem to be in a minority tonight. I just didn't notice that. She began with 25 people in her basement, which grew to a movement that includes 3 million people today. Gloria Steinem has commented, "Women had to fight first for the vote and then for the right to be voted for. No one has been more crucial to this ongoing struggle than Ellen Malcolm. When Women Win will give you faith that one day this country might become a democracy." I love that quote. And in conversation tonight with Ellen Malcolm, we welcome Anne Friedman, a freelance journalist who writes about gender, politics, technology, and culture. She's a columnist for New York Magazine's website, and her work appears regularly in many periodicals, including The Guardian, The New York Times, The LA Times, and The New Republic. She also co-hosts the podcast Call Your Girlfriend, which she describes as, quote, highbrow and lowbrow, unapologetically feminist, and on which she and her co-host, Amanita Uso, are not afraid to, quote, real talk each other about everything from menstrual cycles to workplace dramas. So I think we're in for some real talk tonight. Please join me in welcoming Anne Friedman and Ellen R. Malcolm to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Hello there.
Hi, welcome. Thanks for coming. I think we have to start with the acronym, the fact that there is no Emily. I want you to talk to us about what the acronym is and what it means.
Well, we might as well start with the zany, I suppose, which is our funny name, Emily's List. When we began in 1985, the traditional Democratic Party funders just never believed that a woman could win. And so the women would go to the guys and they'd say, "I'm ready to move up. I have a political base. Will you give me money?" And the guys would say, "No, we're not going to give you any money because, you know, we don't think you can raise any money." And so they were caught in this vicious circle. So my friends and I, who were very angry at this happening over and over again, said, "Well, we're going to figure out a way to raise early money for the women to give them credibility." And so EMILY stands for early money. Well, I know there's some people in this room that know this. What does it stand for? Early money is like yeast. We make the dough rise. Very good. I always think we should go like early money is like. Good job.
So, and talk a little bit about the criteria that you apply when deciding to give this early money to a candidate.
Well, we support pro-choice Democratic women. And what we did, we kind of reinvented political fundraising, because up to that point, there were PACs, political action committees, They almost always had a legislative agenda. They were trying to make friends on Capitol Hill, and they'd raise money for their war chest, and legally they could contribute up to $5,000. So we said, we're not going to do it that way. We're going to give information to our members, and we're going to tell them about pro-choice Democratic women who have a realistic chance of winning. And then we'll send out profiles about candidates we recommend, and we'll tell them about who's running, what they stand for, what's the dynamic of the race. And then each member can write out a check to the candidates that they like. So in 1986, our first election, we supported two women running for the Senate. One of them was Barbara Mikulski. And as I said in those early days, if we had 1,000 members and they all wrote a $100 check to Barbara Mikulski, we could raise $100,000 as opposed to the $5,000 we could contribute as a PAC. So a lot of early money, a lot of individual participation, and of course in our first election, Barbara Mikulski became the first Democratic woman ever elected to the United States Senate in her own right. So it is the power of the small contributor, and it's my favorite part about Emily's List, because, you know, when you join Emily's List, it's kind of like hiring us to be your political staff. We go out, we find Democratic women, we only support Democrats, they are pro-choice, and we give you the information you care about. What do they stand for? You know, what's happening in the race? Who has a realistic chance? So we, as your political staff, do a lot of work trying to figure out who is a good candidate and who has a chance of winning, so your money is going to make a difference. So it's a wonderful partnership of political venture capitalists that have changed the world for women.
Maybe you can talk. So when Emily's List was founded, I was definitely like still in diapers.
Thanks for sharing, Anne.
I mean, I'm being honest here. And honestly, you know, I think it's difficult sometimes for people of my generation to picture exactly what the landscape for women in politics mm-hmm. was like then, and what that vicious cycle really meant or really resulted in. And so maybe you could describe kind of like the environment in which it was founded and why this felt so necessary.
Sure, I'll set the table for what it was like. When I said Barbara was the first Democratic woman ever elected to the Senate in her own right, there have been, I think, 7 or 8 women that had been in the Senate on the Democratic side, but they'd all been appointed. And it was typically the governor really wanted to run for the Senate, so he'd appoint her for, you know, the 2 weeks, but was left on the term so he could actually run. Or it was the widow, and he would appoint the widow, knowing full well that when the term was up, he or somebody he cared about could go run. So there were no women that kind of worked their way up in a normal political career into the Senate. The House, we had at the beginning of the women's movement in the early 1970s, 14 Democratic women in the House. By the time we started doing House races in 1988, the 14 had actually gone down to 12. So 15 years of the women's movement, and we're not making any progress, we were going backwards. So women were stymied. You didn't see them in office. On the Republican side, in 1988, there were 11 Republican women in the House, so you had 23 out of 435 in the House. There were 2 women in the Senate, actually, Republican women in the Senate, so that's all we had in the Senate. So we weren't in big offices. We were a little more in local offices. Women could not raise money. Barbara Mikulski, who is one of the funniest people, said when she was out running for office, she'd have bake sale for Barb, barbecue for Barb, bowling for Barb, you know, anything to get somebody to make a small contribution to her. There were like, you know, $5, $10 contributions. And so we tried to move people up to the $100 level and then basically show women that they could make a difference when they participated in politics. So we kind of taught women how to become political donors, and as I always love to say, add the zeros, which now make, by this time, you know, in the last election, we raised over $50 million. So women have learned a lot, and it's made a huge difference.
We have to talk about 1992.
Oh, yeah.
Which has been labeled for a long time the year of the woman. I'm glad that you brought up Barbara Mikulski. There is a quote from her from that time where she said, calling 1992 the year of the woman. Oh, and I should pause and say this was a year in which, you know, a huge number, an unprecedented number of women were elected to both the Senate and the House. Mm-hmm. And anyway, she said, calling 1992 the year of the woman makes it sound like the year of the caribou or the year of the asparagus. We're not a fad, a fancy, or a year. And I'm curious, you know, if you could talk a little bit about the factors that created that kind of landslide.
I sure can.
And also in retrospect, whether it still seems, whether it does seem like an aberration or not.
Okay. I'll take you back. So we go to 1990 elections, right? Emily's List is grown. We're in our third election. We are the biggest funder for Ann Richards' campaign when she was elected governor of Texas in 1990. Remember Ann Richards, right?
Love Ann Richards.
And you know, one of the things I love about the book, and I think you're going to enjoy too, is we tell you a lot of stories that you probably don't know. And one of them that I didn't know until we interviewed one of her key people was she gave this marvelous speech at the convention in 1988 and had those great lines like, poor George, he can't help it. He was born with a silver foot in his mouth. And Ginger Rogers does everything Fred Astaire does, only, as Anne would say, only backwards and in high heels. Right?
These days that would be unattributed on Tumblr, but like then it's very much, yeah.
So when she went home to Texas, the old boys had a couple of things they wanted to say to her. And you read it in the book. It was a surprising end to the story of the Democratic Convention. So anyway, we go in you know, October of 1991. We are beginning to get known. We have about 3,000 members. We raised $1.5 million for candidates in 1990. We're pretty excited, but it's, you know, it's steady, slow growing. And then President Bush nominated Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court. There we go. Just want to make sure you're into this conversation here. Remember Clarence Thomas. So Anita Hill told investigators... There you go. Now we got it.
That's right.
Anita Hill told investigators that Clarence Thomas had sexually harassed her when she worked for them. And the Judiciary Committee that was confirming this African-American nominee for the court and had gone through the process and everything was going fine, kind of wanted to bury the whole story. And so the chair of the Judiciary Committee didn't want anybody to know about Anita Hill. Who was the chair of the Judiciary Committee? Oh, you guys are really good. That's right. It was at that time, Senator Joe Biden was the Democratic chair of the Judiciary Committee. Nina Totenberg from NPR found out about the story and put it on the radio, and all hell broke loose. And seven of the congresswomen, led by Barbara Boxer, moved over from the House and went over to the Senate and said, well, you know, let us in. We got to tell you, you got to listen to Anita Hill. Barbara Mikulski went forward and said, you've got to deal with this. And so the Senate Judiciary Committee said, all right, here we go. And they had several days of public hearings that everyone in the country was riveted. I mean, we just watched it and could not believe it. 14 white men on the Senate Judiciary Committee listened to Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. Now, in those days, it was sort of the Mad Men world, you know, like the television show. And working women were sexually harassed all the time. It was the verboten subject. Nobody wanted to talk about it. It was the dirty little secret of the workplace. Women would try to defuse the situation. They'd try to make jokes. They'd stay away from the guy. They'd try to transfer in business. I mean, women would try everything, but nobody ever discussed it. All of a sudden, you saw Anita Hill and women who'd been hiding their own stories just rose up in rage and started telling everybody what it was like. you had men thinking, what's the big deal? You know, he patted her on the fanny, so what? And you had women saying, that's disgusting, and somebody that does that shouldn't be on the Supreme Court. So a totally different viewpoint. There were, at that time, only two women in the United States Senate. Dianne Feinstein had the greatest line of the 1992 elections. 2% is great for low-fat milk, but it's not good for a representative democracy. So women particularly, but even men, were outraged and learned that there were no women in these top offices and that clearly it made a difference, that their views were very different and missing in our representative democracy. And it just kicked off a firestorm of political support. In March, that was in October, in March we had the first state primaries, and Carol Moseley Braun in Illinois was in a three-way primary against a sitting Democratic United States senator who had voted to confirm Clarence Thomas. And she spent about $100,000, and he spent about $4 million, and she defeated him in that primary. Well, the shudder went through the political world, as you can imagine. In Illinois, people were voting for all the women on the ticket. They didn't even know who they were. They were women running for judges that nobody had ever heard of. They all won. They were, you know, and it went on from there. We ended up adding four new Democratic women to the Senate, including Diane and Barbara Boxer. We elected, now remember I told you there were 12 Democratic women in the House in 1988. We added 20 new Democratic women to the House in the 1992 elections. And little old Emily's List went from about 3,000 members to 24,000 members. We were the biggest resource for federal candidates in the country. We raised over $10 million, and that was it. From that moment on, Emily's List became an institution, a full-service political organization that does so many things now to help elect women. And it all is because Anita Hill had the courage to come forward and tell the truth about what it was like for women in the workplace.
Do you think... At the time, watching those results and experiencing that like huge wave of interest in Emily's List, did you think, okay, this is it? We're on the upper trajectory. It's happening. Yeah. Or I don't know, what did it feel like at the time?
Oh my goodness. It was just like my 15 minutes of fame, first of all. It was very funny. Anytime it asked me about anything that happened, it was, oh, that happened in 92 to me. Yeah. It was unbelievable. We're full of internet and all these things. We had a staff of 7 people. I'm not making this up. We had the entire database of Emily's List in one personal computer on floppy disks. They flopped. They weren't hard disks. They were floppy disks. And I remember saying to Betsy Crone, our administrative person, we've got to figure out how to process all these checks that are coming in and everything. We can't just like enter this, you know, one person into one little personal computer. And she said, well, there's this thing called networking, but it's kind of dangerous. Things can get very mixed up, and I don't know that we should do it. I said, look, just figure something out. We're not doing it this way anymore. So she went out. But I mean, that was the view of networking in those days. And I basically said to the staff, it's never going to be like this again in our lifetime. This is what Emily's List has been waiting for. Do everything we can, and when it's all over, we'll clean it up and figure out what's going on. But just grow, and we did.
So in retrospect, you have a phrase that you use in the book, which is leaping and creeping. Mm-hmm. And do you think that that Year of the Woman was... the one leap since Emily's List founding? Have there been other leaps?
Many, many leaps.
Seems like there's been a lot of creeping.
Well, there have been a lot of creeping.
Maybe I'm
too
pessimistic. I don't
yeah
know.
Yeah. I heard a wonderful guy named John DeMilio give a talk about the leaping and creeping of social change. And it was for me, who was a child of the 60s and you know, committed to changing the world and making it better. Such a wonderful framework to understand what social change really is. It's a constant effort. And I think constant through lots of different issues. There are progressive values in our country that have played out in labor and women's issues, consumer issues, environmental issues. And, you know, it's the same value stream that kind of comes out in different ways. But it doesn't, like, happen at a steady pace. That often will go through periods of slogging along and thinking, oh, my goodness, you know, in 88 we elected two new women to the House, and then we elected a few more in 90. And then there are these moments where there's this huge leap forward. Some set of circumstances come together, and there's this gigantic leap forward. And then you go back to creeping again. 94, the Republicans took back the Congress. Newt Gingrich became the Speaker. That was worse than a creep. That was a downward dive, you know.
He was the creep, actually.
He was the creep. That's true. But for me, and for people that, like you, I hope, that do this kind of work, it's important to hold that you have to celebrate each tiny victory. Because it's going to take a while, and it's never going to be over. We're never going to achieve everything we want. It's a constant investment of our values and ourselves. And enjoy the little tiny victories when you don't have the big leaps, and love the leaps. So, yeah, we had it in 92, but we had it in 2012, electing women to the Senate. Remember Todd Akin? With Claire McCaskill and all the war on women and the terrible things were going on, and it energized women, and we had a terrific election. And that happens periodically, and we use that at Emily's List to do everything we can and to build our strength to go on and carry through. But it's always, it's a constant, and it's a wonderful investment of our souls in making the world a better place.
So I'm curious to have you read from the book a little bit.
Okay.
And to tell us a story about some positive things that came out of maybe a creeping period.
Okay. Well, I mentioned that when we grew like crazy in 92, and all of a sudden we had the resources to do what I had wanted to do, and we were doing a little bitty pieces, which is to figure out additional ways to help women win besides just raising money for them. And so we started doing things like training people to work in campaigns. We had a program that trained campaign managers, press secretaries, how to do get out the vote. We had a job bank so that our candidates could figure out, you know, when they needed a fundraiser, where are they going to go look? Well, we had a job bank full of resumes, and we'd train people, and we'd always send the best people to our women candidates, of course. We did a wonderful program that we launched here with Dianne Feinstein's race when she ran against Michael Huffington in 1994, and we mobilized women voters to vote in that non-presidential election. And that Women Vote program we then took nationally in 1996, and it is one of the most important things we do now. We are the national experts on how to target and mobilize and energize women voters. We know the gender gap means that women prefer Democratic candidates, they prefer Democratic positions on issues, and so there's lots of ways you can kind of maximize the victories for our women and all the Democrats on the ticket by mobilizing women voters. We have people on the staff that work with the campaigns on a moment-to-moment basis, helping them, advising them, listening, holding hands, making them smarter. And so in 2004, we had a wonderful election in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And it's a great little vignette of what it's like when Emily's List comes in to help. This was the election of Gwen Moore to the Congress from Milwaukee, the first African-American to go to Congress from Wisconsin. She was a state assemblywoman and a state senator. She represented the urban core of Milwaukee, very poor Senate district, poorest in the state. Her congressman decided he was going to retire, And so she wanted to run for the Congress, which meant she had to reach out to a broader constituency beyond her urban African-American district. In the race were two people, but the front runner, and absolutely perceived as the front runner, was a fellow named Matt Flynn. And he, you'll get the picture. This is what happens with women all the time. You know, the political establishment has their guy, and it's Matt Flynn. And he is a very successful lawyer in Milwaukee. He had been chair of the Wisconsin Democratic Party. He had the tacit support of the governor and the strongest man in the congressional delegation. When he started off the campaign, he immediately raised a lot of money. So it looked pretty much to the political world that Matt Flynn had this locked up. So how do you beat the front runner when the political establishment is lining up behind her opponent? So here is from When Women Win. Gwen had been trained by our state and legislative program, but she still had only a vague familiarity with Emily's List. For the most part, she dismissed us as a bunch of rich white ladies. I had heard of Emily's List, but I just knew they weren't going to help me. I'd heard they didn't help black women. But that was precisely where Gwen was wrong. In fact, more than one-third of the women we helped elect were women of color, and we were exactly what Gwen needed if she was to expand her base. So we immediately assigned Jennifer Pelagia, a young staffer at Emily's List, to work with Gwen. At first, Gwen was standoffish. When Jen told her we would support her, she responded, "Oh, I know, you're the people that are going to make me swim across the English Channel. And when I get to the other side, you're there with a warm towel and a cup of hot chocolate." Jen told Gwen she was exactly what Emily's List was looking for, a committed pro-choice Democratic woman who would be an excellent member of Congress. And wait till she saw what Emily's List would do to help. Gwen was a fascinating candidate. In the state Senate, she had become a powerful voice who had real fire in her belly. She gave startlingly candid speeches on the floor of the State House, using her own life as an unwed mother and someone who had been assaulted as a child as an example. "This woman is fantastic," said Jen. "She's one of the smartest people I know. She has a photographic memory. She's crafty." When the community couldn't get any loans for their businesses, Gwen went out and started a credit union. That's typical of the way Gwen thinks and acts. We should have this, so she did it. She was terrific on issues that were important to her district, such as food stamps and housing. The problem was that none of those issues brought in political money. I've never seen a candidate who had such a small potential fundraising base, and Gwen was almost proud of it. One of her supporters gave her a box of pennies, and I saw Gwen literally counting the pennies, said Jen. She wanted to make the point that the contribution meant as much to her as all the hours spent raising money on the phone from white liberals. So suddenly you had an understated, mild-mannered young white woman from the Midwest, Jen, trying to tell this unstoppably powerful black woman what she needed to do. It wasn't easy. When it came to debating, Gwen's rhetoric was not exactly geared to the affluent white liberal donors she needed. As Gwen put it, her style was street. "I know how to argue," she said. "I know the facts. But before Emily, my style was something like this." To demonstrate, Gwen slowly took off her glasses and looked directly at me as if I were an opponent on a televised political debate. "Kiss my ass, mother trucker. I'm going to tell you how it is." And then she burst into laughter. Of course, Gwen was putting us on. She was much too smart to blow up her own campaign. But just in case, we made sure Gwen's rhetorical skills were refined somewhat by the time the election was over. Amazingly, it all began to work. Emily's List legally couldn't do the actual work of the campaigns, fundraising, organizing, and the like, but we had a continuing interest in assessing our races. Of course, a critical part of that process was advising staff, many of whom were new to their jobs, on what was working and what wasn't. So we sent staffers to monitor Gwen's field operations and her get-out-the-vote process, help her with debate prep, and raise money from progressive donors. In the end, we sent so many staffers from Emily's List that Gwen used the name Emily as a prefix for all of them. Emily Jen, Emily Dave, Emily Heather, and so forth, I was proud to be known as Emily Ellen. Gwen was a powerful and much-loved candidate, but it was also true that our relationship with her was a terrifically productive political marriage. In the last reporting period before the September primary, Gwen raised $354,000, four times as much as Matt Flynn, and more than 200,000 of that came from our members. In late August, Women Vote went on TV with an issue ad praising Gwen for her work on education. We were at her side every step of the way. When the votes came in on September 15th, Gwen earned her win in what can only be described as a colossal landslide, winning 64% of the vote to just 25% for Flynn. It was hard to remember that just a few months earlier, Flynn had been the prohibitive favorite. And that's how we make history at Emily's List.
One thing that was threaded throughout the book and is in the very name of the organization is money. It's not easy for anyone to ask for it. Sometimes it's not easy to give it. It's definitely not easy to talk about it specifically. And you're pretty frank about a couple of moments, incidents early in your career when you either didn't want to be open about being a donor, mm-hmm. Or when it was awkward for you to ask donors to Emily's List for money. I'm curious if you have developed any insights about what makes that easier, or how do you talk to candidates and about this issue, mm-hmm. or maybe just women in general about asking for money?
You know, I was nervous about it in the beginning, but I very much believe that when you're asking for people's financial support, they're not going to give because of who you are and what you're doing. They're going to give because they want something to happen. And so with Emily's List, I think that people belong to Emily's List because they want to see more women in office. And if I then can talk about, here's what we've done and here's what we will do if you give us more money, and see how much sense it makes if we do it, and see how effective it will be because you've seen how we've, you know, won over and over again, then it becomes a partnership, really, between us. It's not me down, you know, way down here and they're way up there with all the money and everything. It's a partnership. I have something that they're trying to achieve, a way to elect more women. They have something that can help Emily's List do that, which is give us a contribution. And so from that point, it's just a question of, well, how much do you want to give? And let's negotiate it. Let's figure it out together so we both achieve what we want, which is victory for our women candidates. So I actually love it now because I met wonderful, interesting, fascinating people, and the members of Emily's List are fabulous people. I mean, they really care passionately about making a difference. They care about helping women, and they're generous, and they're brave, and they're willing to take a chance and put their money where their beliefs are. So hanging out with a group like that's actually quite a lot of fun.
And I'm curious also, you know, you mentioned this a little bit with the Ann Richards story about her problems with the Democratic establishment. And it certainly comes up in the founding story of Emily's List, where the establishment didn't want to back women candidates with money. I sort of get the impression that Emily's List was like rogue outsider status, mm-hmm. in the beginning. And then as time goes on, I mean, certainly maybe even at the 1992 year of the woman moment, you're working much more closely with the establishment. And I'm curious if if they kind of came to where you were, or if you had to say, how did that happen?
I actually think we were rogue much later than that. We did not work with the establishment in 1992. The establishment went along on our ride in 1992. We didn't really. I very much thought that we didn't want to play the typical political game. As I said earlier, the political world is really driven by legislative agenda, and there are very few, if any, organizations like Emily's List that just want to win elections. It's a very strange thing to realize. It took me a long time to understand how different we were as an organization. Because all the organizations that we all love and give to, Planned Parenthood, the Sierra Club, it's all about a legislative agenda. They don't really want to understand how do we start from ground zero and build a political organization to elect environmentalists. No, they have a big legislative program, and part of their effort is this PAC that does the political part. The party, on the other hand, is divided into three parts. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee raises money for the House. Democratic Senate Campaign Committee raises money for the Senate. The Democratic National Committee essentially takes care of the White House. And they were all focused on media. There was very little investment in building a political infrastructure. And so what that did for us is not only did we have to invent what a political organization that wanted to win elections did, but it was a vacuum out there. And it was fabulous. So if they didn't train people to work in campaigns, and we had this great training program, our candidates were going to have smarter campaigns in those open seat Democratic primaries that would take women into the House. So it was actually, we were always making bank shots off of the establishment and the way they operate. And to me, it was the most fun. So I didn't want to, like, play their game and let them know what was going on. And so it was all kind of very quietly done behind the scenes. And I think a lot of times they had no idea what it meant. You know, I think the political establishment in Wisconsin is, you know, this is 2004. It's not that long ago. I think they didn't have a clue what was going to happen to Matt Flynn. We did.
So obviously on the cover of your book is Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. Anybody here like Hillary Clinton?
and she comes up throughout. And I'm curious if, you know, when you talk about meeting her, when did you first meet her? Pretty early on.
Oh, yeah. 92, I guess, was the first time I really met her.
Serious year of the woman for you.
Yeah. I told you it was my 15 minutes. I even built a house with Jimmy Carter. It was the strangest year.
In 92?
92.
Anyway, so, you know, she shows up throughout, and I'm wondering, you know, there's not too much of the book that is sort of set in this presidential race that's happening right now, but I'm wondering if you always thought that she would run, or when did you kind of have that slow realization?
Well, I think it would be more accurate to say she had a slow realization. You know, I don't, until she decided to run for the Senate in New York, and that was, I think, a difficult decision for her. She was not the candidate in the family. You know, she was the policy person, the implementer, the behind-the-scenes person. You know, she talked recently about how she's not a natural politician. Well, that was Bill's job. You know, that's not what she did. So there was always talk, you know, about this one. I mean, even when she was, they were still in Arkansas, I'd heard about her, and everybody just marveled about this incredibly brilliant, strong woman. And wouldn't she make a great presidential candidate? But it really wasn't until she got into the Senate and became a political figure that there was any sense that, gee, maybe this actually could happen at some point. She is a wonderful person and candidate. But I have to say, as I watched the debates and I watched the food fights on the Republican side, and I watch Bernie and Hillary on our side, I am so proud to be a Democrat. I got to tell you. And just hats off to both of them. I mean, Bernie Sanders has been very classy through this process. And I'm sure there are people here that are for Bernie. Come on, get some feel the burners here. There we go. Okay, and all of you for Trump? You got lost if you're here. So, you know, it's a hard-fought primary, and just as it was in 2008, and I think it's getting pretty close to wrapping it up. but it will be wrapped up by the convention, and we're all going to get together, and we're all going to work really hard because we know what's at stake, and we know we don't want Donald Trump to be president of the United States. Or Ted Cruz.
Right.
Or any of them, actually.
I'm glad that you brought that up, because the fact that we're kind of generally on the same page, because when I think about the people in my life who are big Bernie Sanders supporters, they care a lot about representation of women in politics, mm-hmm. and that women, you know, are in prominent roles. And I'm curious about whether, I don't know quite how to phrase this question. It seems sort of rudimentary given your history and your line of work, but how important is it that a woman advance the agenda for women? And how important is it to have, like, you know, a woman at the very top doing that?
I think men and women should advance the agenda for women, but I think we have a representative democracy that, as I understand it, means that we will have good policies to take care of this very diverse country that we live in when we bring together all kinds of different people that have different perspectives, different life experiences. They come from different parts of the country, rural, urban, different races, different ethnicities, and obviously gender. And so we, as a progressive, I think, should have a commitment to creating diversity. And so women now are still, with all the work from Emily's List, only 18% of the Congress. We are not living up to our ideals as a representative democracy. And what happens with that is that a lot of issues that are important to women and families are on the back burner until you get enough women to come in. Look at what happened on the sexual assault issue in the military. You know, that has been going on. People have been complaining about that for years. Now there are 7 women on the Armed Services Committee, and Claire McCaskill and Kirsten Gillibrand brought it to the fore, and for the first time, the military was forced to deal with it because women were in power, and women said, no more skating on this issue. NIH, believe it or not, used to do research studies on heart disease and stroke only on men. And so Barbara Mikulski, as a member of the Senate Appropriations Committee, basically forced them to deal with it, with help from men in the Senate, but Barbara Mikulski forced them to include women in these studies. Now we know that heart disease for women and men are presented in very different ways. We didn't even know that until they started including women. That was after the 1988 or so. So it's not that long ago. So women take leadership on these issues. They move things forward. They have different perspectives, different points of view. And there are a lot of really smart women out there. There are also a lot of women that know how to work together and get things done. And boy, it's hard to believe we would have this gridlock and this partisan pissing match if half the Congress was women. It's the women who know how to forge compromise and get things accomplished. So I think the government would work a lot better if we had more women in it. And I think when you see these open primaries and you see, like for the House or the Senate, and you see a number of candidates and you basically can't really ferret out who's better than the other because they're all progressives, they're all liberals, they all have pretty much the same positions on issues, all things being equal, vote for the woman and vote for diversity.
So you obviously write about Geraldine Ferraro's vice presidential mm-hmm. run in the book. It's not a win for women, but you know, there's this part. I'm going to read it because it really stuck with me in the context of like some of the thinking I've been doing about Hillary, but. You know, you write about how the Democratic Party leadership was really interested in having a woman on the ticket, And then you write that after they took that historic step of nominating Ferraro, they went back to business as usual. And then you quote an observer who says, there had been this incredible sense of euphoria when Jerry was nominated. A barrier had been broken. But when they didn't follow through, it was like a punch in the stomach. They couldn't see the significance. And right. Sometimes I wonder, you know, I mean, when you talk to political scientists who study women in politics, they say, well, Hillary is one person. She's not, we can't draw conclusions about what it means for women to run for president because we have one. We don't have many to study. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious of, like, if you think about implications of her run, you know, no matter how things end, if you have dark thoughts about that sort of are along those lines, or like, what is your optimistic scenario and pessimistic scenario?
Well, let me go back to Jerry, because first of all, I think it's very instructive about how the establishment viewed women candidates in that time. There was this incredible excitement. And there, in 1980, they discovered the gender gap in polling and in Ronald Reagan's race. And they said, oh, look at this. Women, I don't think they'd ever even looked at gender. Women seem to have different votes than men, but, you know, they're disproportionate. They vote more for the Democrats. There's a split. There's a difference between how men and women vote. So with Geraldine Ferraro on the ticket, the Democratic Party, my friends, tried to get them to reach out to women voters, and they just didn't have anything to do about it. They did, like, one little piece that had, like, you know, five or six women's issues, education, and, you know, whatever. And that was it. Meanwhile, after the election, we went to a panel that sort of Republicans and Democrats were talking about what was going on. The Republicans looked at Jerry Ferraro on the ticket, and the pollster said they had 16 subgroups of women voters that they were following and studying. They were scared to death that women would come out in droves for Jerry Ferraro and they would lose the election as a result of that. Meanwhile, the Democrats are like, eh, women, whatever. So women voters are a critical part of what's going to happen in this election with Hillary. And we see it now. You know, it is the fundamental, that's the foundation of her victory through the nomination process. And some of the polling that's coming out now against Donald Trump and how women dislike Donald Trump, off the charts. So if it's Trump, I think we may see the biggest gender gap we've ever seen in our lives, because women, Republican women, independent women, they see who that guy is. They see how he treats other people. And they don't like him. And so I think, you know, one of the things we're watching at Emily's List and are going to do a massive women vote program is to make sure we can maximize that. And when we maximize that at the top of the ticket, you know, people go into the polling booth and they start voting. They tend to vote right down the line. So what is going to happen is they're going to vote for Democratic Senate candidates, House candidates, all the way down the ticket. It is why the Republicans are in a state of panic, because it's not only do they think Trump will lose the White House, they think people will be so horrified that they will lose the Senate, probably not the House, but pretty darn close, legislative bodies across the country. And so they are in panic state, and it's not just because of the top of the ticket. And a lot of it is because of what's going to happen with women voters.
Hmm. And so that question, I mean, I don't want to harp on it in making you invent a scenario for the future, but, you know, essentially, do you think that future women candidates who are trying to go above the Senate level, are they going to be judged based on what happens with Hillary?
They will, yeah, there will always be Hillary. I'm laughing to myself. I went to Israel some years ago, and I was talking to some of the women that were trying to organize women in Israel to get them elected to office, and they said they would go to people all the time, and they say, well, what's the problem? You had Golda Meir. Like, that was it, that you knew me. So I assume there will be some part of that. But what is more significant is that voters, when we started, voters had no perception of what a woman candidate was. Not a clue. You know, women didn't run for office, right? And so as a result, they had no reference points, and they'd kind of default to all these sort of gender stereotypes. Mm-hmm. And so they would say to women, well, you know, who's home doing the dishes? And what's the matter with your husband? Is he taking care of the kids? And who does the grocery shopping? And, you know, always descriptions of what they look like and what they wear. So when we started having women run more and win, then voters got a little more comfortable. They understood what a woman candidate was. They realized she actually could be tough enough to be in a campaign. She seemed to actually know how to talk about budget and defense and, you know, things like that. And she did a good job when she was in office. So what we had, basically, we started getting used to that at the House level. You in California have elected so many women to the House that nobody gets into all that nonsense with House candidates here anymore, right? They just want to know what their positions are and whatever. So as the women climb up the ladder, the gender nonsense comes back. So when Nancy Pelosi became the first woman speaker, all of a sudden we're back to her clothes and her jewelry and, is she tough enough to keep the Democrats together? Is she tough enough to deal with President Bush? And guess what? She was. So then Hillary ran in 2008, and there was this horrible gender, ugh, you know, the nutcrackers that, you know, and the iron my shirt, and, you know, her voice sounds terrible, and her ankles are, it was disgusting. I mean, it was just, I was shocked. We're not so far seeing as much of that. I am very concerned and expect that Donald Trump, who has pushed every racist button he can find, will now turn to pushing every sexist button he can find.
And he pushed a lot of them.
So. He's already pushed a lot of them. No, he's just insulting them. Hang on. But I don't think people will stand for it. And I think it's just going to hurt him more and more. And so when Hillary runs, whether she wins or loses, and I believe she will win, she will make it easier and easier for the women that run in the future.
I think we should take some questions, if you guys have questions to ask. Okay.
Hi, welcome and happy St. Patrick's Day. I want to go back to the state legislators, which you briefly brought up, because you know the last few election cycles have been really terrible for Democrats mm-hmm. running for state legislative bodies. I wonder if Emily's List has any special plans to focus on getting more Democratic women elected to those bodies, or maybe have state branches doing that, or any involvement there. We really need to get working on that and soon.
Thank you. That's a great question, particularly here in California, where term limits have been devastating for women. We can't keep the women coming in fast enough. And there's that problem. There's also a problem. You think you have 8 women in the California congressional delegation who are 70 years old and older. So the wonderful, you know, we see Barbara Boxer retiring. I don't think Diane's ever going to retire, but, you know. but, you know, we need to bring in the next generation. It's a constant process, and you more than any place in the country see the nature of that problem. We started in about 2000 training and recruiting women to run. We have a number of organizations that have patterned themselves over Emily's List. You have a California Women's List, I think it's called here. Emerge came out of San Francisco mm-hmm. to get women into the political process. There's a couple of them, Annie's List in Texas, Lillian's List in North Carolina that we work with. So we're trying to do more of that, but there are thousands of state legislative races. And it is a very expensive undertaking. So We are doing as much as we absolutely can, but the need far exceeds our ability to solve the problem. So anybody in this state that wants to get involved, either through us or any of your California groups, I encourage you to do that. More than that, one of the things we found is that women are hesitant to run. I used to laugh, and I'd say, if you asked a man if he would like to run for the state Senate, he'd say, what are you talking about? I'm running for president of the United States. You know, when we'd ask women, they'd say, you know, I've always wanted to run for office, but nobody's ever asked me. It's true. I mean, it's unbelievable. So what I always say when I speak, and I'm going to say it right now to all of you, if you care about politics and policy and you care about community and solving problems, you should run for office. You have been asked. I am asking you to run for office. And I think you know people like that, too, who should be running. Your friends and the people that you work with in volunteer and advocacy organizations, ask them to run for office. We need more people, and it's a great question, and thank you for bringing it up.
Okay.
Thank you. I just have a question for you. In the 32 years since Mondale and Ferraro were wiped out, the Democrats have not nominated someone for national office. And I'm wondering if you think the nomination of Ferraro in some way hurt the party, shied away from nominating women. Because I'm not sure the Clinton nomination is necessarily, if she were Hillary Rodham running as Hillary Rodham, not as Hillary Rodham Clinton, it'd be that significant. No Democrats on the national ticket in 32 years. And I'm just wondering if the
Ferraro. All right. Well, first of all, I don't agree with you about Hillary. I think she is spectacular. And it wasn't some legacy wife that ran around the world restoring Americans' reputation and around the country. And she has, since the time she left school, worked on issues that are important to women and children. I don't need to get into all these things. I don't agree with what you said about Hillary. I think she is a woman and a force in her own right. And I'm very proud of her. I don't think Jerry scared people off. I actually think that, Mondale was in such a problem anyway. It was such a long shot race. And what they were trying to do was something exciting to change the dynamic. And then, of course, once they did the exciting thing, as I said, they didn't take advantage of it. But it also, and this is another social change, this book is sort of like how to be a social change entrepreneur. In all these terrible things that happen, it creates opportunities. And another part of what happened with Jerry is that we saw Jerry go and speak around the country, and women would come by the thousands. They would bring their babies, their daughters. They'd say, look at this woman. And the party was doing nothing really to tap into this potential financial resource either. So I looked at that and thought, boy, there is so much energy out there from women and caring about politics and support of women candidates. I think there's a gold mine out there in terms of fundraising. And so it was one of the pieces that encouraged me to go out and start Emily's List right after the election, thinking that that energy, we could channel that into ways to help women. And so it's one of the most wonderful things in the most awful of circumstances. There's always these little ways you can find things to move it forward and make a difference. And that was one of the Ferraro's thing. So I think the problem is much more that we haven't had a pool of people to run. It's a little difficult to find a presidential candidate when there are 12 women in the House and none in the Senate. And so we've added in our history now 19 Democratic women to the Senate. From our 12 Democratic women in the House, we've added 110 to the House, 11 women governors. We've seen some of our governors, like Janet Napolitano and Kathleen Sebelius, become cabinet secretaries in major positions. So I think we now have a much broader pool, and some of those people that we see in office right now are going to be running for president themselves down the road.
Thanks. It's wonderful to hear you speak as someone from a younger generation who has been alive maybe beginning since the leaps and creeps started happening. Mm-hmm. It has been interesting also to watch as a young progressive woman in the Hillary and Bernie conversations, people of my age talk about what sexism looks like in the progressive community and how this election is bringing out certain facets of sexism that folks my age might not have been aware of. I'm hearing a lot of people talk about, well, there are so many more women in the House and the Senate, and there's so many more women politicians we can look up to. With that in mind, what do you see as the challenges for young, politically aware women who want to run for office in the future, and how do you see sexism evolving and presenting itself in new and different ways for folks my age who are considering a run?
Mm-hmm. That's a big question. and I want to start with saying that I think it's a question your generation is going to have to answer, because you are going to feel the brunt of it. It is interesting to note that I'm talking about a lot of struggles we had getting women into office, and the struggles were from the Democratic Party establishment. Now, part of that is because the best opportunities are in open house seats where there isn't somebody running for re-election. It's almost impossible to beat people, incumbents, running for re-election. So these open seats are critical. But a lot of the problems we have had convincing the political establishment is on our side. So it is not a novel concept that progressive, so-called progressive people don't see what they're doing about women. There are progressive forces right now that will tell you time and again, that woman can't win, she's not a good progressive, this guy is a better progressive, and we don't agree with them. And the facts don't always bear them out, but those guys sure believe it and act on it and trash Emily's list as a result. So we're still in the same battle against establishment of our friends. And at the end of the day, I go back to what I said before. I would never vote for a woman just because she's a woman. I would not. I would not vote for Michelle Bachmann, Sarah Palin, Carly Fiorina. But there are, I would not in any way, shape, or form decide to vote for a woman just because she's a woman. I would, however, think that if you believe in diversity and you believe in a representative democracy, when you see a good woman who agrees with you on virtually everything that's out there, maybe it's a responsibility to vote for the woman.
Hello, thank you so much. I'm a member of Emily's List, but I wanted to ask a question. When you send out the flyers with people's suggestions, but then I'll get the people themselves sending me something, mm-hmm. Is it more advantageous for Emily's List for me to send it to you so that you can show that you're helping raise the money for the people? Do you know,
does everybody understand the question?
Is it
okay, do you give your money through Emily's List or do you give it directly to the candidates?
Yes.
First of all, give it. that's number one. Okay. Then if that's the case, give it through Emily's List, because creating that force creates credibility for women as well. And it's our community strength that is what impresses people, wins elections, make people credible.
That's what I thought.
But the number one thing is give it. So if you talk to a candidate and you like the candidate, don't hesitate. Either go give it to us, through us right away, or give it to the candidate. But give it.
Mm-hmm. Hi, thank you so much. It's been a very insightful conversation, and I just wanted to kind of play off of your comments around establishment and the Democratic Party establishment, mm-hmm. and when we're looking and people are talking about third-party candidates, and you expressed that Emily's List supports Democratic Party candidates. Mm-hmm. Is Emily's List open to, or is this something that you've been approached by third-party candidates? Is this something to be explored? In the terms of, you know, having to fight our own party and to fight for the money and for the space and the time, you know, and people are just get frustrated and, well, can't we just go out and go this alternative, independent, third-party route? Is that, what do you think about that?
The Democratic Party, maybe I wasn't clear about it. The Democratic Party is, or the Democratic Coalition, are not our enemies by any means. We work very closely with our allies in the party and in the progressive organizations. There are some people in this the progressive establishment that can give you chapter and verse why you shouldn't be for a woman. And it sounds very reminiscent to me about how they used to say, this woman can never win. They just have a sort that somehow the woman is never it. But we work very closely with the Democrats. We, in our political system, I have never seen an independent candidate that realistically could win. And so we are all about focusing on pro-choice Democratic women. And we will not support Republicans. And, well, I'm going to tell you a little something about Republicans. When I told you in 1988, there were 12 Democratic women, 11 Republicans. So we were basically 5% of our party caucuses. Today, Democratic women are about a third of the Democrats in Congress. Republicans have gone from 5% to 9%. Nowhere. 30 years, Republicans have not increased the percentage of women in Congress. It is a scandal. And when you think about those crazy anti-women policies they come up with, they are like 9 out of 10 people in the room in the Republican caucus are men. And so there's so few women, and, you know, they are outliers and they are extremely conservative. They don't have an enriched experience of not only understanding what's happening in women's lives, they certainly don't seem to understand how women's bodies work at all. So when you look now and you think, oh, there are all these women in Congress, and isn't that great, and on both sides? No, almost all the progress has come on the Democratic side, and there's a graph in there that I absolutely love. Democratic women and Republican women go like this, and in 1988, it starts going like this, and that's Emily's List.
Okay, two more questions.
Hi there. Thanks so much for writing the book. It really needed to be written.
Thank you.
So, concerning the current election that's going on, who's Emily's List looking at in terms of the Congress, House and Senate?
Where are
the vulnerable
goodness.
Seats, and what are you doing about it?
We have, and thank you for asking that, because we're so focused on the White House in the political discussion these days. One of the big issues is whether or not Democrats can take back the Senate, and we have phenomenal candidates that can do that. The first step is to hold on to the seats we have, and you're going to have a race here with Kamala Harris in California that we're helping and involved in. We have a lot of diversity in our candidates this year in the Senate, which is really exciting. Donna Edwards is running in April in a primary for Barbara Mikulski's seat. There hasn't been an African-American woman into the Senate since Carol Moseley Braun. Tammy Duckworth just won her primary this week in Illinois, and that's a great take-back opportunity. Maggie Hassan, who is just a phenomenal woman, who's governor of New Hampshire, is running against Kelly Ayotte. So when you go to emilyslist.org, you're going to read about some terrific, wonderful Senate candidates and, of course, House candidates across the country. So we have a lot to do in this election. And just as we learned in 92, when the environment gets right and the opportunities are there, we have to jump on them. Not only do we want to win the White House in this election, if it all falls apart by the Republicans, we want to take advantage of every single win we can get. And we're going to take back the Senate. And the Senate that we take back is going to do its job. And when the president appoints someone, nominates someone for the Supreme Court, they're going to do their constitutional job and hear and take care of the business of approving that.
Do you have any feelings of conflict between wanting Hillary to be our president and Bernie's positions on some issues?
I don't think I quite understand the question, but I mean, Bernie is very good. You know, he's a good progressive, and some things I agree with and sometimes I don't, but I, you know, Hillary is my candidate. So I'm not quite understanding your question.
On a balanced scale, Hillary is always going to come up the winner for you, even though Bernie may have positions that you admire.
Oh. Is Hillary always going to come out the winner for me? Hillary, to me, brings a lot of new things into this process that Bernie does not have. And it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with Bernie, but Hillary has been such a leader on women's and children's issues. If you look at the conversation right now, we've done very little in this country to come up with policies that take into account that our family structure and work lives are totally different than they were in the 1950s. You know, all the parents are working, and there's tremendous issues about how do you balance the child care and take care of everything. So now you have Hillary out there talking about paid leave and paid sick leave, paid family leave, equal pay for equal work. She's got Social Security policies that take into account that women have interrupted work lives. And so she is driving an agenda on economic development that includes pieces that are important to women and families that haven't been, and to men, that's exactly right, by families, that's exactly right, that is a different voice and a different perspective than I think we've ever heard in a presidential election. And I think that's pretty exciting.
All right. That's our last question. Thanks to everyone for coming
tonight.
Thank you,
Anne.
Thanks
to
Ellen.
Thank you.
Join you in the lobby.
I hope you like the book.
Yeah. Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.